Welcome, all of you wine and true crime lovers. I'm Brandy.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Texas Wine and True Crime. Thank you for being here, friends, for this week's episode, The Case of Candace Mosler. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Brandy.
We are looking out the window into
Yeah, we're kind of at a remote location today.
We are.
We're at the lovely Horseshoe Bend.
Yes, we are. Horseshoe Bend Cellars. Vineyard and winery, all three, yes.
And sitting across from us is Gabrielle Painich.
Hi. Thank you for being here.
How are you doing? Thank you so much for having us out here.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's Sunday. The sun is out. We are sipping wine and we're in great company. We've already had multiple tours.
Oh, yes.
So we can't wait for Gabrielle to tell you more about Horseshoe Bend. We should probably tell people where this is located.
We'll tell them.
That's you a want me to tell them?
Fantastic idea. You would love talking
okay,
about
Okay, so we are in Iowa Park, which is right outside of Wichita Falls. I think I've said this on the show before. I was born in Wichita Falls, and then we moved like a couple of weeks or months before the tornado hit in 1979.
Yes, where you first started developing your meteorological...
He said that on the way
what
do you here. Say?
What is it that the groundhog...
He thinks I'm obsessed with weather. And so when I kind of am. And I always know when it's like what's happening.
You're like Punxsutawney Phil when it comes to weather. You know what's happening the day before or perhaps months.
I mean, we go tornado hunting over here, so...
Yeah, yes. And Phoenix, our daughter, I think she's taking after me because she's like, oh, mom, let me look at the Dallas radar. And
meteorological prognosticator, I believe. That's the word I was like looking to spit out there. That's a 50 cent word right there for you.
50 cent said it, or you just...
No, like a 50 cent word. You know what a 50 cent word
I've
is?
I've never heard of that.
Oh, it's a word someone may use to
describe something?
To say you can predict the weather.
I've never heard that.
You could say prognosticate or...
You're so fancy.
Predict.
All right.
But actually the term came from when you used to send telegrams. And so the larger the word... the more money it costs because you pay like a dollar or not a dollar, whatever it was, whatever amount it was for a letter. So the bigger the word. So they had the 50 cent and 75 cent words. It's basically just a term for people.
I had no idea we used bloating, to pay money based
bloating
on
the conversation. Of
words.
Huh? Well, you learn something new.
Well, of
every
course.
Day.
You used to have to pay for every minute on your cell phone.
Well, that's different. But
why?
People counted the words in your letters?
They counted the letters before you sent a telegram. Remember when you used to go send a telegram to somebody? Tick, 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 tick,
yeah.
Tick.
Oh.
Yeah, that cost money. It wasn't free.
Well, I mean. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's Sunday and I've had a few glasses of wine already. So.
Hey, man, that's a racket. Communication's a racket.
Racket.
I mean, I remember my father had to keep, it was so expensive back in the day to have a cell phone and pay. And so he had two cell phones because the bill you could, it was like cheaper to have two cell phones to use versus having, because I mean, you would have just for his business, $1,000 a month bills.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy.
Hmm.
Or maybe it was his burner phone. I don't know.
I was about to say, is that what he told you the two phones were for? Because one was
no, that was a real thing.
The other.
It was so expensive. Like you're because if you, I think it's because if you got to a certain amount too, it even got more. You know, so you basically balanced it out.
Interesting.
That's for that AT&T unlimited $99 unlimited deal.
Okay.
Sorry, a little peek into telegraph. And,
hey, that's all right.
Cell phone history.
Okay, so if you went to our live show, you may have heard this case we're going to talk about today, Candace Mosler out of Texas. So, Chris, this is in the 60s. We're going to go back a bit. I do want to give credit and reference to my friend over at Texas Monthly, Skip Hollinsworth. He did some great research on this case. I did look at some newspapers.com articles of when this was sort of happening. Because the trial actually takes place in Miami, but she's from Houston.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, too, how much media this captured at that time. I guess it said it was kind of the equivalent of the O.J. Simpson trial. And
it was like huge.
Microfiche and things of those newspaper articles.
Well, and we'll talk about why it was so big and what this woman sort of... she was very
glamorized.
Well, it
happened in Texas. Everything's big in Texas.
Yes, it is.
Yes, yes. But interesting enough, when we go through this case, and we hear about the verdict and really how this all went, we think kind of like wacky Texas, right? Like strange verdicts. I always use Candy Montgomery, right? Like typically small petite women don't axe someone to death, right? With 60 axe wounds, but she is acquitted of that. So Candace Mosler was sort of the celebrity coming out of her car into this trial, and people were actually clapping and rooting for her. So we're going to talk about that. Okay. And I'm really glad you're going to be joining us in this case. Typically when I have wineries on, you talk about your winery, which you will do. Yes. But you're going to join us in this case. So I'm very, very excited. Okay. So let's talk about Candace Mosler and give you a little history about her. So she was actually born and raised outside of Atlanta. She moved to Alabama for a little bit. That's where she meets her very first husband. She ends up having a child with him. And then she ends up with another gentleman, and she marries him. Now, here's what's interesting. So John Rockefeller? Why am I forgetting his first name? Is it Rockefeller? I know Rockefeller. Who is the father and the son, though? The father was, it's John D. Rockefeller, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure I had John D. Rockefeller right. So she ends up meeting John Rockefeller's son. Okay. And then her daughter is born, her second daughter. She's married. Well, she ends up giving the middle name to her daughter, Rockefeller. That is. And so when all this trial will eventually go on, we'll talk about this. In her deposition, she is asked if the child's name is Rockefeller, the middle name is because it's actually the child bore by Rockefeller, that she may have had an affair. And her lawyer said she could not answer that question.
Was that on Maury?
That was not on Maury.
John, you are the father.
I mean, Rockefeller is a big name.
Oh my gosh. So yes, they end up meeting. By the way, this woman dated Sammy Davis Jr. and a lot of other people. So
and she was kind of a knock around gal as well too. And I always, I was wondering too why she never hitched her wagon to the Rockefeller, horse to that wagon, or however you say the saying. I mean, because
she's married at the time, and that's probably has a lot to do with it. And then she ends up having the child, but then that relationship doesn't work out.
Or, you know, I mean, maybe get a little baby mama money, baby daddy money. How's it go?
Daddy money.
You just think, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. His name was Winthrop Rockefeller.
Who knows? Maybe there was some hush money.
So some accounts, people say they became very close. And then again, like I said, years later in a court hearing in Houston, they will ask her that question about her child. You know, is this an illegitimate child born by the Rockefeller son? And you just haven't told anyone. And then her lawyer said she could not answer.
I mean, all they have to do is just DNA test. And that now we know.
Yeah. Now we know. Out. Yeah. So maybe Rita, her daughter did eventually get a DNA test. I don't know. All right. So she ends up with 6 children. We'll talk about that too, naturally, from relationships and marriage. But then they end up adopting 4 children. And here's who I'm going to talk about. We're going to talk about Jacques. Okay. So she is married then now once, then twice. Well, the last husband, he ends up moving her to Houston. Okay. Jacques moves to Houston. She actually meets him and they are living in Alabama, but he decides this is where he's going to take his practice, his work, his banks, which by the way, they're all over. He had 3 banks in Florida. He was a real estate investor. He was dabbling in all kinds of investment businesses. So she is considered a socialite in Houston. Okay. Now, when she was in New Orleans, before she met Jacques, she was actually, there were several rumors and verified sources that she actually ran a brothel of sorts, that she herself was going to be a model and an actress. And at this time,
a madam.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this time, she's a single mom trying to make it in New Orleans, right? This is before she meets Jacques.
Just trying to find money
somewhere. Yeah, so she's just trying to make ends meet and she's trying to figure out her way. Well, one thing she was really good at, and people started to notice, is so she started to volunteer for different nonprofits, and she would
she's very good at networking with rich men.
She was. And this is how she ends up meeting Jacques, is because she's looking for donors and donor donations. And she ends up targeting him, right? She's doing her research, and this is they people who look for grants do research just like this nowadays, and they find out who the big donors are, who the big players are, and that's how she met him. And they end up hitting it off. They end up getting married, and he says, okay, we're getting out of New Orleans, and we're going to go to Houston. So Houston is where this takes place in the 60s. She has a 28-room bedroom house in River Oaks.
That's a lot of rooms.
That's a lot of rooms. River Oaks in Houston. If you've never been through this neighborhood and you're in Houston next, you should just go.
Well, I wonder if this house still stands.
Okay, so there is a lot of old money, old homes in this area. So my guess is I think there is a good chance that it's still there.
I wonder, too, if they had it built or if that was something that was built before.
I don't know if he had it.
I couldn't find any mention of that. Like, it was an existing dwelling. Not that it has any pertinence to the case, but
yeah, I don't know.
I was wondering if it's because, like, you know, well, the Davis house out in Fort Worth, I think, is still standing, and that was kind of a very lavish. That's a whole other case we'll talk about another time.
Yeah. But
it gives the address, but I'm not seeing if it's still up.
Yeah,
if it's still up or if it's or if someone's taking.
We'll do a Google Street View of that.
We will. Yeah, that's a good Google one. We should be able to find it.
we're broadcast remotely from the front porch of
River Oaks.
We'll show up out there. So I'm pretty sure they have a guard gate.
Front porch of their home.
Yeah. Okay, so this is where her and Jacques are going to raise their family. They are in Houston. She is. Considered a socialite, a Houston socialite. So she is throwing big parties, meeting with big names, having people from all the neighborhoods in the River Oaks neighborhood and bringing everyone, you know, into her parties. People say she was very interactive, I will say she was a networker, right? Like to get to know. Well, here's the thing. When you come into a place like River Oaks from New Orleans and her background, lifestyle, there was some talk, right? There's some talk with the ladies of where are these people from? What did they do before? So there are several people in the neighborhood.
The country club talk?
Yeah, like the country club talk, right?
Yes. We love those.
Yes, country club talk. And where
we had that for one summer.
We did belong to a country club.
3 months. We had 3 months of country club talk.
All right. So
Brandy was trying to be a socialite in Farmer's Ranch.
I was hashtag success. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So this is when people start to notice that Jacques is going to Miami and he ends up like not really coming back. He owns a luxury oceanfront apartment I think it was like what, Key Biscayne? I think that's the name of it, is the little island.
Yes.
Yeah. So he owns an apartment there. Well, they notice that, you know, she's not really going, but then she decides that she's going to go visit and she takes 4 of the children. Now, I also want to talk about, I said they had 6 kids. Well, Jacques saw I don't know the communication back then, if it was newspapers, if it was television, where he saw this, but he's on a business trip in Chicago and there are 4 children that are now orphaned. Because their father had just shot their mother and their youngest sibling. So now these 4 kids are becoming part of the state. And we're talking back when, and this was probably in the 50s when this adoption took place. So whether it's money, whether it's easy access, I'm sure the adoption process looks a lot different today than it did back then. But they able to adopt these 4 children and give them a home and a life. Mm-hmm. So that means total, they have 6 children.
Yeah, he had 27 other rooms to fill in that house. So.
Yes, he did. There was plenty of room for those kids. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of them on a private jet, all standing there together. So at this time, she's got 6 children. Now, people said that she loved her kids. She was very doting, even though she had a lot of help. She had maids and she had butlers and she had that. In fact, they lived on the property in different quarters. So she had enough help. So she did have the 6 kids, but people said that her kids were kind of everything and she wanted to make sure that they had a good life.
Well, that's a good mother. Then.
Yeah. I mean, you know, she was doing what she could, I think, from what my research, she was doing the best she could. So In June, they decide to go, her and the four kids, she's taking four of the kids, to go and visit Jacques in Florida. Now, this is June of 1964. Now, when she gets there, she is complaining about a severe migraine. So from what we know in the research, she went to go and visit the hospital 4 days in a row. So she's there with the kids. Every time she goes, she leaves the kids with Jacques, except this last time.
So she took them with her.
She took them with her. She's supposed to, so what we know is that she stopped at a hotel to mail something. I guess you used to stop at hotel. Do you know that also concierge of hotels? Because we covered a case about this. I think this was in El Paso. They actually used to have concierge services who would take your car to get service. Like, let's say you broke down and you were staying at a hotel. It was up to the concierge to find you a place nearby to have your car fixed while you stay at the hotel. Very different than probably our concierge service today. Maybe in somewhere like the Waldorf or New York hotels, or maybe some other fancy ones, Ritz-Carlton's, maybe they still have a little bit of this sort of customer service. Yeah, things are more self-service.
Like, you got to put mayonnaise on your hamburger at
Fuddruckers. That's right. Nowadays, yeah, now so, when you go to the concierge desk, half the time there's nobody sitting there. So,
yeah.
So I think the concierge looked a little bit different back then. Okay, so she takes the kids this night, and they go, and they said that by the time they got home, it was 4:30 a.m. So she's at a late night visit in the hospital. She gets a shot for her migraine. The kids and her walk in the door. And that is when they find Jacques wrapped up in a...
I saw a bathrobe.
I think he was... Well, I mean, it's 4:30 in the morning. So my guess probably is he's probably watching TV or getting up or just in bed or lounging, whatever he's doing.
If he's doing stocks, they open up at 5 in the morning.
That's right.
Stocks has got to get up early.
Yeah. So I'm sure... And he's, you know... People just get up in the middle of the night, right? Or maybe he was up in the middle of the night because when he's found, he is, like you said, in his bathrobe, stabbed 39 times and bludgeoned to death. So the kids and her walk in on him being, he's dead.
He probably just wanted a glass of water in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so
I'm still wondering what she was receiving for her migraines at the hospital, especially 4 days in a row.
Having it every day in a row, that's a little concerning.
Well, it's just different medications, too, that they use nowadays. And so, I mean, I don't know. That's just kind of interesting.
I'm curious what they gave her, yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to know. I mean, certainly it's going to be documented when she was in the visits and everything, too.
Well, they had to go back and look and see her story, right? Because immediately... They are thinking, one, this man either has a lot of enemies because he does a lot of work, right? And he deals with a lot of people. And this is what Candace tells the police. Jacques had a lot of enemies. That's what she says. And people wanted him dead. And here's why. Well, when they start to go back to their hometown, remember, they're in Miami right now. This is not where they live. They live in Houston. So they go back. Police go back in Houston. And they start to hear from neighbors and people that know the couple that, oh, there's some problems going on. And that the biggest problem is that they find out. Oh, and I also want to say, she accused Jacques of having trying to pick up men. So she would say like he would maybe possibly pick up men, which he could have done in Miami. Maybe he went out and he brought someone home when she had the kids with her. So she starts throwing several.
So she's suggesting he was gay?
Yes. Or just living a.
Kind of like Charlie Sheen picking up some.
Yeah.
Men that didn't look like men.
No, I don't think like Charlie Sheen.
Miami could be like his away from home type vacation to him.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. And if you're spending that much time away from home, he doesn't attend the parties, he's spending time in Miami, it's the beach.
Beaches are beautiful.
Well, and I kind of assumed or figured that something else, you don't spend that much
there
time
with your
wife.
There could have been. I mean, I don't know. I didn't dive into
There's nothing really reported.
Really background, but nobody really came forward and said anything when we're going to talk about this trial. So she's trying to basically push it away from her. Well, here's what police find out of what's been going on in Houston. Mel, her nephew, had moved in with the couple when her sister called and said, listen, your nephew needs some help and you've got plenty of room in Houston. Can he come there, live with you, and get his life together. And she said, of course, he's family. Absolutely. So he comes, he ends up moving into the mansion. Jacques gives him a job working for one of his businesses, and he's trying to help him. Well, what police find out from neighbors is that the reason Jacques has been in Florida for, at this time, at least a month, several weeks, they said it is because there was a blow up and she is having an affair with her nephew, Mel. And that's why Jacques kicked him out, fired him from his job, and then left to Florida. So now we have accusations of incest going on, and there is another motive, right? So police start to think, is this little love triangle gone wrong? Is this Mel or her wanting him dead to get his money? And so they can have this relationship together. And guys, that's the case in the way that they took this, which is why they end up being both arrested.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean, if you see it from that point of view, I mean, you can kind of tell then that they wanted the luxury style, but yep. You've got Jacques that's kind of in the way. Yeah. So they have to figure out, okay, well, how are we going to get this lifestyle, but then kick Jacques out, make sure he's not coming back.
Yeah, and Mel ends up moving out, right? He ends up moving out and becomes a mobile home salesman, I do believe. He ends up being in real estate eventually in his life and then dies.
Well, and you wonder, too, like, did they have any really substantial evidence to their relationship? Does this all just hearsay rumors? Did they admit to it? I don't think they ever admitted to it, right?
They did not admit to it, but here's what they did find. When they went and searched Mel's... Yeah, so they found pictures.
Yep.
They found love letters. Mm-hmm. And her letters, so her comment about the letters was, I talk to everyone I love that way. That was what she told the police.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Because they were like, well, you talk to everyone like this? And she was like, well, because it would say, like, I miss you. Mm-hmm. I need you in my life, those sorts of things. And she's like, well, I tell people that all the time that I love and care about. So that was her answer to those letters. But they found pictures of them at a nightclub, surrounded by other people and friends. And then they interviewed those people.
Oh, okay. So I guess.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think there was like a trickling of evidence, but nothing
like. They found a diary as well that kind of said some of these things too in there.
That's right. Yep.
Well, and clearly if they're out in the Houston nightlife, they're not being very
discreet.
Yeah.
I mean, no, like, people saw them together.
Yeah. Because she was.
Everybody knew
her. Regularly written about in the newspaper as far as her, the equivalent of our, Dallas Observer used to have the,
what?
Well, I can't.
Oh, like the,
it's so thin now, but they would get like people at events and they would take pictures of people out.
Like paparazzi styles nowadays.
You're right, they did.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, they used to do that. Whether it be.
Yeah, they would almost go say to big famous
people,
in Dallas
but yeah, it'd be pictures. Like just kind of Dallas, known Dallas people that were in the community and stuff, and so because they were donors in the community and
yeah, big donors in the community.
Yeah.
All right, so Jacques is dead, and they're looking now into Mel and Candace and seeing if they wanted him dead to take his money and be together. So they start. Well, first of all, they arrest them. They find out Mel took a one-way flight, bought a one-way ticket, took a one-way flight to Miami the same day that she went to the hospital and the same day Jacques is found. Okay? So he takes a one-way flight to Miami, and then the day after, he takes a one-way flight back to Houston. So they uncover this. Okay, well, Mel is in Miami at the time he is killed. Yep. Why is he here? And if this relationship is not going on, if there's nothing, if him and Jacques have no relation and not working anymore, why does he come to Miami
to see them? That's a bit hard to cover, to keep hidden.
Oh, my God. Girl, we're going to be talking about a lot of things in this case that were, like, hard to overlook.
Yeah.
But then we'll talk about how this actually ended up. All right. So they are... first of all, this is something you don't typically see anymore. We saw this with the Menendez brothers. I feel like that was maybe, if anybody knows after the Menendez brothers, if they know of a case where an attorney is representing two people at the same time in the same trial, I'd like to know. But at this time, the one defense attorney is representing Mel and Candace.
Okay.
Now in Texas, he was actually, he had beat, I think he had got 300 acquittals as a defense attorney at that time. And so he was very well known. He was known for getting people off. And he attacks the victim in his cases. And that's what he did. He basically made Jacques look like he was having sexual affairs with men, and that he had enemies within the business, and that Candace and Mel were not having an affair, that it was ridiculous, that these their family, she's just doting and loving. I mean, this woman.
So he kind of made it to where like they didn't know what was going on. In Jacques' life type of thing.
Yeah, like this mystery. Like yeah. Candace is the only one who's really giving us information about what this man was like type of thing, right? And people, okay, so I want to talk about the day of the trial. She gets out of her car and they said, but Chris is right. They actually compared this trial to a today O.J. Simpson trial. So I think-
It's the circus around
it. Was a circus. I think they had 40 news reporters from 40 different media stations. Now, y'all, this is Miami. We're not even talking Texas yet. Even though this happened in Florida, which by the way, they come out with some crazy verdicts in Florida too. We've seen some strange verdict cases come out of there. So the circus thing, it's a circus. But she gets out of the car and there are people cheering for her. There are people cheering for her. You would have thought she was a movie star, they said, right, when she walked out of the car.
I mean, everybody know her.
It was bizarre. I mean, yeah, it was so bizarre. And that's the other thing. It's like, this isn't even Houston. Now you're in Miami. And so it was very strange.
You wonder
how
her popularity, or I don't say popularity, yes, but just her image would have got
her status type thing.
Transfer all the way to there.
Yeah.
I don't know. But maybe just the... how big the case was, and
well,
it was
and how big he is in Miami, right?
Yeah, as I say, it was covered probably equally.
It's pretty shocking that someone that's well known that has all this stuff is now dead.
Yes,
and they're like, wait, what? What happened?
Well, not only that, they're writing about it in Miami and the Miami Herald and different other news sources, but they're also writing about it in Houston. I mean, it's front page news in Houston, but they're not in Houston to read this, right?
Right.
And so you have all these people in Houston talking about this, and then you have this trial going on in Miami. So let's talk about the trial a bit. There's a lot of details about this trial, so I don't want to like go into every single particular detail. But like I said, Jacques basically was presented as someone with a checkered, even though he was very successful, possibly checkered background, probably having affairs on Candace. You know, she's just a nice lady who has six children and trying to help her nephew out, you know? So this is really how they positioned them in court. And I think people felt sorry for her. I at the end of this verdict, one of the jurors started crying and told Candace, God bless you, ma'am, and good luck. And by the way, the jury was 12 men, no women sat on this jury.
That's interesting.
So not surprised by the verdict with having 12 men. Mm-hmm. I think if there was a woman, would it be different? But then they also said women were trying to get her autograph, telling her that
I don't know about that though, because I think especially to portraying the husband in the negative light of him, you know,
they totally focused on that.
Like, I would think the men would be more apt to find her guilty than a trial of women.
The jury selection probably nowadays is different than back in the day. Because nowadays they go through a lot of steps. And I know, like, a few of the questions are like, well, do you know the case? Do you know what's going on? And if they typically say, well, yeah, I've heard of it, well, then that's one way to get you not on the jury selection.
Yeah.
So. Well, and it could have been a play, too, by defense, because since she was very manipulative and probably very good at charming people. And maybe he thought that would work to their angle as well. But I don't know. I think having just from the evidence that was presented, whether we know it's true or not about him, it paints him more in a negative light. And I would think of having some women on jury too, they would definitely be siding with her. But who knows? Yeah. Like I said, maybe he knew the defense attorney that she would charm the pants off of him. And
I mean, nowadays it's different how everything's done nowadays than it does compared back in, let's say, the 50s, 60s. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for sure, back in the day, you can probably, push your way through and make your charm and everything to make people feel a certain way about you. But nowadays we've got, it's a like a few seconds where we can see social media.
Exactly. We can figure out who you are.
We can figure it out really quickly nowadays than you could have back in the day. I mean, back in the day, it probably took a good while.
Yeah. No. And she would, I mean, that's the thing is she kept honing in on the fact that she didn't need his money. I wasn't with Jacques because of his money. I was with him because I loved him. I think she even told one reporter, like, I would have been happy living in a telephone booth or something along those lines.
She was also
with him.
A single mother, though, when she first met him.
When she first met him, she was
trying to find angles to get money.
That's right.
So that's why I find it interesting is she was a single mother needing money. And now she's saying, well, I don't need his money. Okay. Well,
yeah,
that's kind of interesting of an angle then.
Yeah. And I think that was the appeal of her for some people, because you have this woman who at the time had two children. She's living on her own in New Orleans. She's gone through two divorces.
Well, and that's the thing,
right?
But you bring a part about social media too, where I don't, her background was never brought into this. And so I think if people, because she did abandon her children.
Yeah, she became kind of the, what do you call it?
Because when she met him, her,
mother,
I don't.
Mother dearest, mommy dearest.
Well, no, but I mean, her older, she had the children from before. Because when she met him, those children didn't come with her. When she kind of, she left him with another family member, right?
I think so. Yeah. I think it was like both. She had relationships with them because she ends up taking a couple of them out of the will.
But when she married him, she didn't take her older children that were her children with her down there, right?
I don't know.
I don't think she did.
I always saw where it just says the four kids.
That's what I mean. Like they kind of put those kids aside, got four new kids that were adopted. And just the fact, the whole, I mean, just imagine like if people were to know about her background as possibly being a madam or a prostitute
then
and
they
things like
thought
that.
Her differently.
It could have been. Yeah. Because I mean, quite frankly, that's, you know, painting him in the negative light, not being able to look back at her,
because I feel like that was Miami, but not Houston. Here's the interesting thing about this dynamic with this woman. In Houston, people are questioning this, right?
They may have known.
They
about
don't know
that
who
stuff.
She is.
And they may have
right?
had more witnesses that could be able to do that because
she
was pretty sneaky. I had read that he had had her birth certificate altered to show that she was younger than she was.
So this reporter who I mentioned that Skip Hollinsworth actually got to meet, I think he's in his 80s now. Skip reached out to him and he even said when he started to write, she wanted him to write a documentary about her, basically like an autobiography about her life. And he starts trying to vet some of the information she's giving him and it doesn't add up. So there were birth certificate issues, age issues, where she was from issues, like things that she kept. He actually told Skip Hollinsworth, like herself still haunts him till this day. He says she's just mysterious.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, she
but
had
she's
a lot
likable
of
and friendly, but no, but he couldn't verify any information about her.
Yeah, I mean, if she was a single mother, she was probably hiding, you know, a majority of her identity because she probably doesn't know who these men are. But I mean, changing the certificate—that's quite interesting.
Well,
to make her younger.
Yeah.
Well, and I also read that she had basically had undergone an entire. I don't know. What do you call it? Her whole body was basically from surgery.
Oh, like plastic surgery?
Yeah, but I mean, like everything. Like
very, very early days of
very early day. But I mean, I read that she had like everything done.
I would not trust them.
Her figure.
I mean, that's probably where people were honing their skills. Like there weren't breast implants at that time yet, but there was probably just... things they did.
Oh, you think?
Like a tummy tuck here and there kind of thing.
Breast implants didn't come out. Well, the silicone, I guess, the one, because I don't think that came out until the mid-70s.
That's a good Google. It has to be 70s, right? Because I feel like in the 70s,
the only reason I know, I think there
women.
Was that show with David Schwimmer, a movie.
1962.
Okay, so yeah.
So prior to the introduction of silicone implants by Cronin and Groh in 1962, women sought breasts in different injections type of thing.
Okay.
So I think that's when like the
kind yeah, of, I was
that's
trying
when
to
they started manufacturing between the 62 and 64 is when they started manufacturing the silicone. Okay.
So I would imagine she probably was one of the first to receive those.
I would imagine.
Cause there's there's a movie I remember watching, you know, on HBO. It was with David Schwimmer played the doctor where they're, you know, this groundbreaking, I don't want to call it groundbreaking. I mean, that's probably a little bit much. Not so, groundbreaking, but
yeah. So before the silicone implants, it says they did silicone gel or oil directly into it with an injection to make them bigger.
Oh, okay. Well, that would make sense.
I feel like that would hurt.
Yeah, probably.
All you want to know about the history of enhanced breast enhancements.
Yeah, that'll be another.
You can only
episode.
Hear we'll that here episode. On Texas Wine True Crime, guys, because you're not going to get that anywhere.
You learn
else.
Something every day.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. So, okay. So they're in court, and people are saying, wow, this is, by the way, the judge made, I think it was anyone under the age of 16 had to leave the court because there were actually people who had brought their kids and tried to get it. I mean, the doors, people were knocking down the door in the courtroom trying to get a seat. So it got so salacious with the talk of the incest and like sexualism that was going on in this trial that the judge made everyone leave. That was, I believe, under the age of 16.
No, 21 and up.
It was 21. Oh my gosh.
I mean, I would not bring my child to a case like this.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So they were like so excited. Some of the women that got to go in there because they got to kick anyone out that was under the age of 21.
I mean, if a mother wants to hear, but I would never bring my child to hear something like this.
No. So they said it was quite graphic. And, you know, it's funny, like her and Mel, they said like, you know, they were sitting on opposite sides of the attorney. So there wasn't a lot of, interaction between the two of them like during the trial, and people are probably staring at them like, are they together? Like trying to figure it out, right? Is this really a couple? Could they have murdered this man to be together and that's her nephew? This woman is rich and is a socialite in Houston. I mean, it's like it has all the makings of like this crazy story, right? Which, by the way, after the verdict, there's a book that's out 10 days later. And so there was already a book going about this. So trial comes to an end. Y'all, they are both found not guilty of killing Jacques. And she's sitting in the front seat of a car. Mel is in the back seat and she turns around and there's a picture of this. And she's giving him like this big gracious smile. And he's, you know, looking at her with these little doting eyes. And that is when, like I said earlier, one of the jurors says, God bless you, ma'am, and good luck. They didn't think this woman could do something like this. And I'm going to assume that they probably thought the whole affair thing between her and her nephew was baloney. But we know it. But yep, that's it. That's the picture right there.
I mean, if looking at this photo, I can see, I mean, I can kind of see in her eyes that she definitely has that loving look towards Mel. But then with her smile, I mean, she looks obviously happy, first of all. But second of all, she looks like she's like, okay, so we got away with this. Let's just head back to Houston. Let's just go back to our normal lives. But she definitely has that loving look towards Mel right now in that photo.
And it was 3 days. By the way, the jury was out for 3 days. This wasn't like in 2 hours and they came back. They really thought about this.
Oh, wow.
Well, and I think, you know, given that the trial was in Miami, that's probably a big part because, like you said, the everybody back in Houston kind of knew this to be somewhat true, the relationship. So, sure, she probably was not capable. She's this petite little woman and can probably barely lift arms and legs because of all the surgeries and the enhancements and things like that. So she's not going to be able to go do 39 stab wounds, much less bludgeon someone to death. But clearly this guy's 6'4", like they say, built by a linebacker, you know, and he was there on the spot. But yeah, they definitely got fairly lucky.
Did they find any? So if you keep
well, there's a finger, the handprint of him in the apartment, but they can't verify when it was there because he was a family member.
Yeah, he had been there before.
So, I mean, he had been there before. So there's no telling, you know, it wasn't like it didn't belong there.
So that was the
only thing they could find that was any sort of physical evidence that he was at that location. But everything else is just kind of circumstantial.
Well, so it did speak about how when Jacques was getting killed, that he had some, I guess, defensive wounds on him.
Mm-hmm.
Normally when you're finding somebody, the other person's going to have like on their hands or on their arms. Did they find anything like that on Mel or
I couldn't see anything like that. That was really the,
cause that would clearly indication that it was one of them.
Yeah. I mean, he sounds like, Well, they kind of describe Mel as kind of a paunchy older gentleman, clearly.
I mean, Mel's like 6'4", 250 pounds.
That doesn't, that doesn't mean that somebody can all, you know, you're still fighting some, you know.
It's 7:30 in the morning. I think he's probably in his robe asleep. A lot of men would just fall asleep on their bed in their robe. That's not uncommon. Your dad hangs out in his robe at night. If you're ambushed in the middle of the night, I can see someone just being found in their robe.
That's why you always got to be ready.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think he was attacked.
You tell me to hide the knives and the guns in the house, but yeah, you wait. Yeah, something's going to happen.
You wait.
You're probably sitting there in your robe.
Just don't tell anybody where they're hidden. We'll be good. Okay, so after the trial's over, okay, remember, we're in Miami now. But this is where the trial takes place. She goes back to live in Houston. And the neighbors are like, she's back? Like, she came back to the neighborhood, and she does. She comes back to the neighborhood. She actually starts purchasing businesses. She sits on the board of a few of Jacques' companies, his bank. She's on the board of directors. So she's traveling around, continuing business as usual with several things. I think she sells off a few things. I mean, she gets the money. I think at the time it was 6 to 9 million, which I think today is like 40 million. And that's what his estate was at the time in the 60s. But she's going on with life as usual. And people were very, yeah, because I mean, imagine if you're in Houston, right? And you're watching and hearing about all this stuff going on in Miami with your neighbor, right? And now it's over.
Well, I mean,
she's acquitted and back.
Yeah. And if you find, you know, if you find you're the one to find your husband, you know, or wife, you know, dead on the ground, you wouldn't really be getting back up to life. You mean, you'd probably take a few weeks off just to kind of recalibrate your life and go through all the emotions. But
do we want to take a wine recess?
Yes, let's take a wine recess because I want you to tell us about a couple of your wines, and then we're going to talk about more about Horseshoe at the end of our episode. But yeah, what?
We'll definitely
what kind
talk
of
about this one I'm drinking because I love it.
It's a good one.
This is the blackberry.
That is, yes, that's the blackberry one.
Yes.
So, because she's got the cherry and the brandy. So,
yes, I do.
So we're in Iowa Park. We carry about, we have about 30 recipes, but we carry about 20 on hand year round. You have the Kirsch. It's a brandy with cherry. So that one's really good for sipping wine. It's 17% for alcohol too.
Strong.
So
I can tell.
If you want to have one that's, you know, great, good wine to have before sleeping, the Kirsch is the one.
Okay. Well, and this, the blackberry is delicious. It's not too sweet. It has this smooth, velvety finish on
it. I call it the Jolly Rancher wine.
Oh, it
tastes
delicious.
Like the blackberry Jolly Rancher.
Yeah, it is. Amazing. It's so easy drinking and...
You said that's your bestseller.
That one and our Life's a Peach. So the Life's a Peach, it's a Chardonnay with natural peach juice in there. And I tell all the ladies that walk through the winery, I said, if you want the wine that you're going to be laying in your chair outside on the patio watching your husband mow the lawn and do yard work, Life's a Peach is the one for you.
Get Brandy a couple of bottles of this.
I haven't tasted
it's
that
a
one
great
today.
One. It's very light. It's very crisp.
Okay.
And it tastes like sparkling water, honestly. That's how easy you can drink it.
Hmm. Okay. I might have to have a little
sip
of that.
Yeah, the Kirsch was delicious, too. And I noticed you did have quite a few that were fortified with brandy as well, and I thought that was kind of interesting. We love brandy, too.
Aw, thanks. Okay, so I did try the Riesling and the Chardonnay.
I had the Riesling.
Okay, so
I have to try the Chardonnay when we get back down. The Riesling was delicious.
They stuck with the dry Riesling, right? Which is really how Riesling should be made.
The German tradition.
Yes. Yeah. And it's not sweet, where most people, I think, when they pick up a Riesling in the store, they're expecting it to be somewhat sweet. This is dry, so I love it. It's so good. The Chardonnay is really good. And she was telling us how you take the Chardonnay and then add the peach, which I love that
you're peach wine
for the peach wine. So, okay, friends, you remember we covered Horseshoe over the holidays because we had a couple of their wines. We also had their chocolate sauce, and I didn't know they had two chocolate sauces. And
I know I'm looking out the window and I don't want to interrupt, but I thought that's what I saw rolling out of the, your garage there. Is that a 55 or 56?
Yes. So my dad is my dad loves vehicle or loves antique cars. So this is actually a 1955 Chevrolet Bel Air that my grandpa had gotten. And when my grandpa had passed away, he given the title to my dad. We also in that same garage have a 1931 Model A with all original parts and everything.
Wow.
It's a double clutch, so it's a little pain to drive sometimes.
Wow.
They both do not have seatbelts, but the Model A does have the original, it's a horsehair in there. And then on the side of the building over here is a 1928 Model T that he's still working on. And then my sister has a 1975 or 76 Volkswagen Super Beetle.
Oh, very cool.
Oh, my gosh.
So we love antique cars.
Yeah, that does.
So does he.
Is he leaving, or are we going to be able to drive down there and look at that?
Go ask if you want to take a drive in it. The wind in your hair.
Yeah.
There's not much wind that goes through my hair
beard
these
hair.
Days.
Wind yeah, in
my,
his beard
in
hair.
My beard hair. Well, can you tell us how you got started?
Yeah. So we've been living in Texas since 2012, but my dad was doing corporation jobs at the president and vice president level. And it got to a point where I was about to graduate from high school, and he wanted to do something for the family so that way he can pass it on down to me or my siblings, because I've got three other siblings. And so they were actually at Blue Ostrich, and they were looking around, and they love the quietness of it. They love how the winemaking process, because we do make wine at home sometimes for, you know, personal consumption. And so they were like, you know what? This is, you know, something, it's nice. It's at your own pace type of ordeal. And so we were looking at different prices. California was really out of our budget, and there really wasn't a whole lot that we could find in Texas. But mom did some digging, and she actually found this winery. It used to be called Wichita Falls Vineyard Winery and Gates Winery. They had two labels under the same business. And so we lived like 5 minutes away, and we did not know this was here. And so we came out that same day and saw a for sale sign right in front of the yard, talked with the owners, and they were kind of getting their older years, and they were wanting to move back to Florida to be with their grandkid and their daughter. And so it's been about a year negotiating. We finally bought the property in October of 2017.
Excellent.
Wow. So we just hit our, five-year mark on owning it. And then we just hit our five-year mark, for being open for 5 years in March.
And everybody's involved in making the wine, correct?
So it's me and my dad. We make the wine. But we do have my mother. She does all of the kind of the business paperwork and all of our payrolls and stuff. We do have my sister Anna and Ashley, and then my brother Tyler. So they help with our social media. My sister Anna did all of our label. She did our graphics. I mean, she went hardcore on the logo.
Yep, that was great.
It's when we tried getting it stitched on shirts, it was 14,000 stitches. And I'm like, Anna, because you have got something simpler. But we threw the names around of Quarter Horse Winery, Painich Winery, just something different. But we ended up with Horseshoe Bend Cellars because we own half of Horseshoe Bend Lake.
Okay.
So we figured, and that way, because we're kind of in the middle between Iowa Park and Wichita Falls. So we really weren't Wichita Falls. We're really not Iowa Park. But we also wanted to keep it local to the lake that we own. So
the lake's here on the property.
Yes. So we own, there's three lakes that are on property. There's Horseshoe Bend, and then two rivers, Buffalo Creek, and then there was Wichita River that we have.
And then your dad had a background in winemaking, or just kind of started this all from scratch, learn as you go?
Yeah.
It's all chemistry based. It really is. So, I mean, obviously we went to a lot of the seminars that Blue Ostrich was holding, and I know we went to one in Lost Oak Winery. And so it was pretty simple. We asked TABC, they were very helpful because we are TABC, ATF, and FDA regulated. And so they were very helpful in getting all how to do your tax for your taxes, because every month we have to do paperwork to show the state how much we bottled, how much is on site, and then we have to pay taxes on those. So they were very helpful.
Do you ever take on apprentices?
That
work for charcuterie boards and glasses of wine.
We could. I mean, I
tell everybody. I obviously love drinking wine, and we talk about wine. But yeah, I'm fascinated by the process, just of how he said it's chemistry based.
He wants
based,
to get in the fields. He wants
but
to.
It's, you know, it's all chemistry. Kind of, yeah.
It's really simple. It's basic chemistry.
I was going to say, kind of, it's simple to create this delicious product, you know, that we. Mm-hmm. We've all grown to love.
It does take about a month to ferment. That's probably the longest part of me having to wait for the wine to finish. Yeah. But otherwise, we are harvesting this year. We should schedule that about August, September. Depends on the Brix number for the sugar content of how, where it's going to be at that time. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, this is the year. I told myself this is the year that we're going to be doing a lot more festivals, a lot more wine walks. And we've reached out to about 50 of them, and we're slowly hearing them back, but we're excited. So I told my staff, let me get into these wine walks first, and I'll figure out who's going to be staffing it later.
That's great.
As long as I can get us in, we're fine.
Well, since we're talking about just the property, when are you open? What kind of events do you have? When's the best time to come? What do our listeners need to know?
So we are open year round. Okay. I know a lot of wineries typically do seasonal. We're year round. So we open every Thursday through Sunday. Hours are a little bit different each day, but more than likely we close at 7. And we just started doing Wine Down Sunday for the past few months, and it's been really great. So it's every Sunday from 3 to 6, we have half off glasses of wine. So might as well come out, save a few dollars while enjoying some really great local wine. We also do painting parties out here. We also do murder mystery dinners. So we are going to start bringing that back in April. You sign up. It's a 4-course dinner, 3 glasses of wine, and you get to figure out who killed our victim.
Oh my God. I saw the sign when I was walking up the stairs. I'm like, yes.
And sometimes, and all of our, murder mysteries, we use an actual person to do our fake dying.
Oh my God. Can you please include us sometime?
I will.
Yeah.
I'll send y'all some free tickets.
Oh my God.
As long as you know how to gamble.
Can you believe it? I absolutely know how to gamble, but I have never done a murder mystery dinner. It's amazing. That is like, what? People are like, what?
Did you just ask her if she knows how to gamble?
Well, it's fake. So we do like play money and everything. Cause, we do speakeasy style, versions.
That.
We do Western. We do, masquerade. We do weddings.
Can we sleep out by the tent? In our tent by the lake.
If you want to, that's fine.
We'll just pop up the back of our Subaru and sleep there. We see that in the commercials.
We do have. We are part of Harvest Host, and Harvest Host has RVs come on property. We have about 300 to 400 per year, and they're more than welcome to stay anytime during the week. So during the week, like Monday through Wednesday, they have the whole property to themselves. But I'd say about Saturdays and Sundays are the time when it's really best to come out here because it's the weekend.
Yeah.
Might as well drink. Plus, I mean, we also have a wildlife. We have, not only is there a horse next door, but we have deer that come through. We do have wild boar, but they stay on the backside. There is a few, you know, roaming cats like mountain lions and bobcats that tend to stay in the back of the property. But occasionally I have seen a turkey pass through.
Well,
or
I mean,
the neighbor's cow likes to come and say hi.
I mean, we passed some roosters and goats on the way, you know? I mean, it's... It kind of reminds me of Ovilla a little bit, like the backyard. Like, by the way, kid friendly.
Yes.
You can bring your kids. It's gorgeous. There is a patio upstairs, downstairs. Plenty. I mean, bring the soccer ball.
Yeah,
we
were planning on recording this on the patio. However, the horse and the dogs next door spotted me up there and wanted to chat. So
yep.
And we are too much racket.
Not as long as nobody minds a little neighing in the background. We could have kept it outside.
But. Yes. And we are also pet friendly too. So that's one thing that makes us different from the wineries in Wichita Falls. We can have the animals come into the winery as long as they're still on leashes, but we offer them treats because I was like, I'm not going to have a dog sit in the Texas heat in the car. Like, no, the dog is coming in and they can come in the tasting room. They can come in the banquet hall up here. We are very pet friendly here.
We wouldn't dare bring our dog out here, but
we do appreciate our pet is not friendly. Well, sometimes.
Yeah, it's like she's constantly trying to tell us that Timmy's lost in the well.
Y'all
just like Lassie, but always, constantly.
Yet in a very pushy, aggressive way.
Yeah.
And then otherwise, we just started doing Sunday brunches. They're the right now they're the first Sunday, but we're going to start doing first and third during the summer.
Okay.
And it's from 12 to 3. It's between 29 and 35, depending on if you want the alcohol drinks or not. And
Who does all the cooking?
We have a local chef come out, Southern Girl Catering. She does an amazing job. Okay. So she provides all the food
for
us.
Is that the same?
She's from Wichita Falls.
Okay. No, yeah. Different. Similar name. So.
Similar name, though. Yeah. When we add a different place that we get to, the kind of okay. They have the same thing. They have a really nice commercial kitchen. They don't do any cooking, but yeah, they have someone that comes out and does it.
Catering.
Well, they come and they bring all the food, but use the facilities to prepare everything. Yeah.
And we've been, and she does all of our murder mysteries as well. We also did a Valentine's dinner. Okay. We're going to start bringing back, wine pairing dinners. So just because it was just a little cold during the winter time here, our weather in Wichita Falls is unpredictable. Yeah. I mean, we could have sunny one day and sleet literally the next day, and it has happened.
Yeah. No, on the way here, it said, watch out for icy roads. And I thought, did I miss something? Did I sleep through a blizzard, or our
weird car, the thermometer and the temperature gauge?
I probably just pushed a button. I don't know.
No, it just says that. It'll say, yeah, beware of ice on the roads. Like, dude, do you even know where we're at? Yeah. Like, I mean, seriously?
You may never know. I mean, there could be also another time where it'd be great weather. Then you get sleet. Oh, and then, hey, there's a tornado coming.
We have turned our air on and turned our heat, then back off, and then turned the heat back on
within 24 hours.
Well, last week.
Yeah,
I think.
I've done that too.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Gotta love Texas.
Oh, I know.
But that's a little bit about us. I mean, we've got great staff. I mean, we'll take care of you. We want everybody to come into the winery feeling like they're family and making them comfortable. We just had recently a mother with her baby, and her husband is overseas right now. And she sent us a message, you know, thanking us because she said she felt very nervous coming in, but she said, that our staff, even our owners, our owner sat and talked with her for a few hours, and the other customers, she said she felt very welcoming and it felt like home. And she was very thankful that we were able to make her at ease with being with a newborn.
Yeah. Well, that's what it's about. And I felt the same when I walked in this place. So I can see how people would feel. It's almost just like going and sitting on my patio, right? Yes. And just enjoying the beautiful weather.
But I have someone to take care of you.
Oh, yes, exactly. She
has someone at home. It's
me. We'll take care of both of y'all.
Oh, see, honey? Yeah. They're go here fetch for you
me
too.
My, so go fetch me my juice.
Fetch.
She says, dispatch with yourself and go fetch my juice.
He gets a smile on his face like that when he has to tell someone to fetch something.
Yeah. So we're here to take care of you. So that way, I mean, we tell customers, when you start your tastings, you go find a seat because we bring you every single glass. Because we do our tastings one by one because we want to talk to you about the wines and what they're tasting and everything. So we will actually bring you each glass one by one. And that way you don't have to move a muscle until you're ready to pay out.
Oh, very nice.
Okay. So I'm feeling like, because you are going to send us home with some bottles today, and we are actually going to cover most of your wine in April.
Okay.
So I'm excited, and I think just to keep the tradition of the winery, when we are at home, we should have someone serve us their wine while we're doing this.
Just give me a call. As long as I can stop by Culver's, I'm good.
Oh, that's right. Yes, she said she was in Dallas just
yesterday.
Culver's. Wait, what's Culver's?
It's a Wisconsin fast food place. They do butter burgers and they have cheese curds. And let me tell you,
where's it at? I've heard that name.
I went to the one that was around. I think
you're saying
it
so matter of factly as though we've been there.
I've never been there, but I know it. I know what it is.
It's all from Wisconsin.
Really?
Because I'm from Wisconsin, so I grew up on Culver's. So, and we've had taken deliveries to Dallas. I mean, like boxes or bags and everything to Dallas for people. And I tell them, I was like, as long as I can stop by Culver's, I will bring you some bottles from Wichita Falls to Dallas.
And it is also big in Canada. Am I right about that? Isn't Culver's the one that's like all over Canada, or do I have the wrong place? So they're known for their cheese curds and their
cheese curds are amazing. I love them.
I love cheese curds too.
Okay, so Canada has very something similar to a Culver's that. But I guess it may
every
not be a Culver's.
Every place, like what's the East Coast has the Wawa. We have a Bucky. We have Bucky's.
I don't think it's Culver, though. I'm not seeing anything in Canada, but I'm seeing a lot in Wisconsin. I mean, because it originally started in Wisconsin, and I mean, it's their style of burgers is kind of like it's like the smash burger type.
Yeah.
So it's amazing.
But you call them a butter burger?
They're called butter burgers. So when you look at the menu, they're called Butter Burgers. They're Culver's amazing. Now. I love them.
Yum.
I don't know why. I mean, they could have more butter, we'll but hey,
I'll go pick it up. For me. I'll go pick it up for you at the house, and it'll be ready for you when you get there.
I love that.
It's amazing. And then they have the concrete. It's like you know how Dairy Queen has their
like the Blizzard.
The Blizzard, yeah. So they have, it's called the concrete.
Oh.
It's ice cream. But if you ever stop at Culver's, get their lemon ice.
Okay.
It's amazing. So it's like it's kind of like shaved ice, but it's like lemon, and it's amazing. Oh, I love yum. It.
All right. Now I'm hungry. I'm really hungry.
So Culver's?
Yeah, Culver, exactly. All right. Well, I'm glad you're here with us. Thank you so much for having us here.
Thank you for having me.
It's been fun. I hope we come do a live show here, because I know a lot of people ask, like, when are they going to be here? And we're like, oh, wait, we weren't going to open this up to everybody. We were just coming to visit with them. And you were like, I don't know if I should say when y'all are going to be here. I don't know if they're going to come and open doors and knock.
I thought that was pretty cool. I was like, so I was a little worried because we have a bell downstairs. Yes. It's pretty loud.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know
about
that.
You just set up here and put some speakers.
I know, right?
And
people just come up and say hi. So yeah, fun.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being here. I'm glad you're doing thank this you. Episode with us. Yes. Friends, come check out Horseshoe Bend Cellars. Again, you're going to hear all about them in April when we taste some more of their wine and Chris pairs it with a few dishes. So excited about that. If you need more information, reach out to us or reach out to them directly. HorseshoeBendCellars.com.
Yes. So yeah. And then otherwise they can find us on Facebook too.
Perfect.
Horseshoe Bend Cellars, and it's our purple, and it's a horseshoe logo with grapes on it, and it's got a wood background. So that's the logo.
Perfect. And we will share that also on our socials. When you hear this episode, so you'll see that. Mm-hmm. All right, let's jump back in the case, guys.
Yes.
Okay, 1971. Now she is back in Houston. Like I said, movement and shaken, sitting on board of directors, traveling around. She ends up marrying again a gentleman named Barnett Garrison. Now, he again is much older than she is. He owned several different nightclubs. One night, the fire department is called because his nightclub is on fire. And they couldn't figure out what had happened. And then rumor has it that they believed she actually lit the nightclub on fire.
Was it like some insurance policy?
No, she was just mad at him. Oh, okay. There was rumors that he was possibly having an affair, or that she may have been flirting, or there was...
I thought about that too, but also thought that...
They also had go-go dancers in this nightclub, which kind of made me think, jealousy.
Well, I mean, I thought he could have done it himself too, like you said, for insurance, or just, you know, a lot of times, I mean, that was, you know, you run up all the credit on the place and then burn it out, and who knows?
So she was
that's a shady world.
Yeah.
Go-go dancer nightclubs, you know. That's got to be a little bit on the underbelly of Houston, right?
That's right. And a Houston journalist actually asked her about this. And she says, quote, I certainly would understand doing such a thing. But she says she didn't do it. But then she says, I certainly would understand doing such a thing.
Yeah, or hired somebody. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, I think at this point, too, she's starting to develop quite a bit of a pill habit. Correct?
That's right. Prescription medication. Her children will eventually, when they're older and adults, will come out and say that their mother self-medicated constantly and sort of had these weird, sometimes they were reality scenarios and sometimes they were just kind of made up in her own mind. And you just were dealing with someone who was a little...
A lot of people were self-medicating at this point. I mean, you went to the doctor and you said you had a headache and you were getting Percocets.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
That's how it was back in the day.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
You told the doctor in some instances what you wanted, you know? You
kind
of made your shopping list. Needed, and plus, given her access to money and things like that, you know, and it's if Michael Jackson can hire a doctor to... come anesthetize him every night with propofol so he can go to sleep in his oxygen chamber. I'm pretty sure things were like that were going on down in Houston.
I mean, imagine that. It's so crazy.
Well, I mean, so
great way to sleep though.
So her quote there, I could see it, you know, if she was doing it, I could see it because, you know, you've got go-go dancers and probably beautiful women coming up to these clubs trying to, you know, find the owner to, you know, probably get some free drinks there.
Yeah.
I could see some jealousy occurring. Oh, yeah.
Especially the kind of woman she is, right? Because when Mel, by the way, I don't know if we mentioned this to our listeners, but her and Mel continue this, really, her nephew, they continue this relationship after the trial. But then there are rumors that he started having affairs, like, was he's 23 at this time, 24. Yeah. So he's meeting other women, you know, he probably didn't have any plans to be with his aunt forever. Right.
Well, and he also became quite successful on his own.
Yeah.
And where he didn't really need hotels need her.
And buying restaurants. Like he was, yeah, he did. He did. But they end up breaking up. So people, rumor has it, he started to tell people he was getting tired of her and annoyed with her and really wanted out from underneath her is kind of the way that I took it. So she probably had her thumb on things and she was supplying him with the money and a place to live and all of these really luxurious lifestyle. Right. And so that was the whole premise of the case is they want to be together. They're trying to get Jacques out of the way. Well, now she's got another husband and it's only a year later when he is found on the stone patio in a pool of blood at her mansion. What they come to find out, and I remember, this is a 3-story mansion. So they said he flew. I say flew. He came off the top of the 3rd level roof.
He probably flew for a little bit.
He was flying, all right. And he lands, but his injuries, a lot of them internal, he looked like he had really gotten beat up badly, right? So they determined him falling from that distance would not have caused all of that damage to his body. He ends up in a coma, ends up in the hospital. So he didn't die.
What now, floor did he fall from?
They think the 3rd.
So if you're falling,
they don't really know because he's found on the ground.
Right.
But they believe it was from the 3rd floor.
Because if they look at kind of the internal damages, of like bones broken or like your lungs collapsing, they can kind of figure out the depth of how far that would have gone.
Yeah.
But was there any, like, besides, like, what kind of internal damages did he have?
I don't know exactly what his injuries were, but it looked like,
well, I mean, it's
when you're pounded on somebody, right?
Oh, okay. He had a really, I mean, TBI of some, you know, traumatic brain injury.
That's right.
Because I had read, too, there was some suggestion, say he was bleeding from his ears, which can happen from a bad, from a collision on your head. But I guess there was some suggestion that maybe the assailant perhaps may have used an ice pick that was inserted in there.
Into his ear.
Yeah, there's an effort to. And so, because just the lack of memory, but a traumatic brain injury can also have that too. I mean, we know people have been in car accidents and things like that. And literally it's like they're functioning today, but there is these little pieces and bits that they miss that never regain those memories.
Oh, there are people who fall off ladders and hit their head who die. Like, and you don't have to fall very far, right? No. It really is just how you land.
Yeah.
But just some of these injuries look like he had been physically assaulted. And then bruising is one, right? You're going to get certain types of bruising falling off a roof,
right?
But head to toe. I mean, the guy just looked like he had been severely beat up. And so they theorized that she probably hired someone to beat him up and then throw him off of the roof to make it look like an accident. Remember, he did not die. He's in a coma, guys. And when he comes out of this coma, he doesn't talk about luck on this woman's side. He doesn't remember her, doesn't remember being married to her. All he really remembers is that he went to Rice University. And so there's no recollection. He can't say, these people were beating me up. He has no recollection of what happened to him. So not held accountable for this.
Initially with the shock, the motive would have been perhaps money, but she clearly had more money than this new husband.
Yeah, because say if he was if it was a face plant or if it was on the back of his head?
I think he was found face down in a pool of blood.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, was there any bruising on the back of him?
I don't know about. I didn't have the autopsy on it, but it just said that. Well, first of all, it was ruled accidental. They ended up ruling in an accident. But here's what the researcher said, that she wanted to, you know, she asked this guy to write a book about her, and he's vetting all of this information that he can't, like, that's just not adding up. He heard in his research, and this is something he shared with Skip Hollinsworth, was that that she had hired two men to come and beat up her husband and then throw him from the top of the roof to make it look like he had accidentally fallen.
Because everybody gets on their third floor.
Yeah. Falls off.
Roof,
yeah. Or accidentally falls off. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I just got to say, note to self, you just never date or marry anyone who was formerly on trial for perhaps murdering their husband.
Did he know about her first trial?
I don't know. I mean,
he had to. He's in Houston. I mean, if he's a Houston native, they're in the same neighborhood.
Clearly, he would see it.
But her.
They were living in her mansion. I imagine.
Who cares if she's acquitted? That's still, just to raise that suspicion.
Okay. Well, she ended up, by the way, after this, she goes on to date a country western singer. Sammy Davis Jr., several doctors.
That was probably very controversial in Houston, 1970s.
She goes on to date people who you would think would know about this or know about her. But, I mean, she did.
I mean,
she
went on to date. Unless they still saw her as a victim type of thing. Like, you know,
a lot of people did.
Yeah, like, you know, oh, she lost her husband.
She was found innocent, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not like... I mean, she was found innocent in a court of law. And what do you think? Well, the justice system, right? They heard the evidence, and this is the conclusion they came to. And
how many people thought OJ was innocent after he was found not guilty?
Do you want to know how many people in my school halls of high school? I can remember exactly where I was when that verdict came out. I was sitting in the hallways.
They don't matter.
Oh, but you don't think people were cheering and hollering like them? These are kids, and they're
hollering and cheering. People were excited about it. But I bet even some of those people that were excited that he was found not guilty still knew he was guilty just because of the nature of the relationship and things like that.
I don't think I was born yet when that happened.
Probably not.
That was obviously now.
It was 1995 or 6.
You watch these trials that are on every day, and that's like the first one I can kind of really remember. We remember watching the, I was bartending, and I remember watching the stinking Ford Bronco chase on TV. Like, what in the heck is going on? And then the trial is on every day. So, captivating.
It was very captivating. So he lives. She goes on with her life. She does not remarry there, but like I said, she had a lot of suitors. She ended up dating a lot. The children, let's talk about the kids. She ends up taking three of the kids out of the, inheritance, totally out of the will. She leaves much of the fortune. She's going to leave it to Rita, and also Norman Jr. And those two are actually her biological children. Her youngest child, Eddie, which was out of the four that she adopted. But she ends up leaving Dan, Chris, and Martha completely out of any inheritance. Two of those children will actually end up at UT, and they will turn around and sue Candace for money because she was only giving them $350, I think, a month or something to live on. And she was supposed to be giving them, $350 a month for living expenses at UT, and that she was supposed to be giving them much more from their adoptive father's estate. So they end up taking her to court. I didn't really dive into like what that was like. I'm sure that if there was anything decided, I'm sure they got it sort of out of the court, right? It didn't go to trial or anything like that. So sort of this mommy dearest thing role she's taking on. In fact, she will tell people the reason she took them out of her will is because she didn't feel loved enough by them. They didn't show her the kind of love that she felt as a mother, that level of respect that they did not show to her.
So she left them out of the will. Lived a lot of her life in a haze of pills and things like that too.
That's right.
I mean, I think, you know, like you say, you mentioned earlier, she was a doting mother and all stuff. I mean, you know, who knows? You never know. I mean, they had all this help and she's throwing these lavish parties. She's going to social events and things like that. She's not dragging those kids around everywhere with her. So who knows? No. I mean, you know,
and she had help. So when she did bring them around, I mean, she had, but isn't it funny when they're in Miami and she brings the kids there to visit Jacques and they go to the hospital, there's no help around, right? She is just there visiting him by herself. So interesting.
Yeah, we draw very strong comparisons to you know, shortly after this was the Cullen Davis and Priscilla Davis trial out of Fort Worth.
We're going to talk about that one.
That'll be one week. We're going to do.
Next month at our April. But live show.
Yeah. It's. I mean, that is a juicy case, but kind of the same thing. They're Fort Worth socialites, mm-hmm. and so he kind of meets this, you know, woman not from, she kind of from a different side of the tracks, who kind of steps in this Houston nightlife. And you know, it's the 70s, kind of the late 70s, mid to late 70s. You know, it was a different time. A lot of the adults were going out and kids were left at home and partying and doing a lot mm-hmm. of stuff they shouldn't be doing.
And we'll be drinking your wine in April, so we'll need it for that case. that's a giant one. Oh, yeah.
That one deserves a good cherry Kirsch. Sure
does. I'm sitting home with y'all.
Yeah.
Well, we might finish that by this.
Yeah. So, just
put in a lockbox until then.
Yeah. I love that. So, okay, Jacques is buried, right? So when he passes away, this is the husband she went on trial for. He's actually buried at the Arlington National Cemetery. So in a weird sort of turn of events, when she dies, right, she ends up passing away. And she's not very old, I do believe. I think she passed away in 1976, 1977, around that?
1976, so she was 55.
Yeah, because she basically was... kind of an overdose.
Yeah, she was having accidental. She had multiple medications. So many,
and probably could lost track of
how much
what she had taken earlier that day. And
because it says she died in her sleep.
Yeah.
So.
So here's what's. Jacques had actually only been dead for 12 years when she died. So think about that. That all of this happened within 12 years between his death and her death. So the other husband, right? And then all of this other stuff that was going on. But, okay, so she ends up in this weird turn of events. She requested in her will to be buried next to Jacques at the Arlington National Cemetery. And
I still don't know. I don't know how that's... I just didn't think they let, I thought that was only for veterans, but you know, you mentioned money, but that's a federal cemetery, right? I mean, that's run like federally, like for instance, where your father's buried out in Grand Prairie, like mm-hmm. your mother can't be buried there, can she?
I think you
yes,
can.
Yes, you can.
Okay. So maybe it's only a spouse.
Yeah. If you were, so there, cause it's nowadays, like, I think since they were spouses at one point, I think she still could, like, you know, it's like when a service member passes away, they are given the flag mm-hmm. and it's usually the spouse that takes that.
Yeah. I just wasn't sure if the rules were.
Yeah. She ordered the executors of her estate to have her body shipped to Arlington National Cemetery and buried right next to, Jacques. Oh,
you could just put my urn of ashes in your casket because we know I won't be buried.
She told everyone that she wanted to spend eternity next to the man that she had always loved. Now, isn't this just like, is it the psychopath in someone? Is it the narcissism in someone that gets... Because I think she was involved in the crime, right? I don't think it's coincidence that Mel just happened to fly to Florida the day the man dies.
From a prestige angle.
But is it like I got...
That's a pretty big deal to be married in Arlington mm-hmm. National Cemetery.
But do you think for her, it was like a...
I mean, on the list of cemeteries, that's top dog.
Well, yeah. Everybody would have thought she was going to be buried in Houston.
I know, but I'm just saying like...
Even when Skip did this article, he talked about this. That's
kind of, you know, clearly she's...
But is that the last word? Is she getting the last word? Is she like putting herself there and saying?
No. I think it's like.
Oh, you think it's more prestige?
That's a pretty big deal to be buried there. I mean, that's a, you know, it's like.
Is the rules the same nowadays as they were back in the day?
That I don't know.
Who cannot be
that,
there?
I don't know.
But I mean, I think that would be a big deal. I mean, you know, like I said,
I don't think it was just prestige. Funerals. I think it was a little bit of narcissism and a little weird of like control. I was found not guilty. I really did have something to do with killing you. And now I'm just sort of getting the last word. Like, but I'm going to be buried next to you. Mm-hmm. So
we disagree.
You still can't get rid of me.
It's also, I mean, think there's it's her some first weirdness husband with that too. So she probably sees it as also a way of like, this is the only person that she feels has given her love.
Well, it was her second. Yeah. It was her second, sorry, husband.
Second husband. Yeah. Yeah.
The first one, again, like she was 19 when she married her first husband. And he was, I think, 12 years older than her. And because of her lifestyle and the way she grew up, her mother died when she was giving birth to her 13th child. So her grandparents sort of helped not really raise her because she was considered older, right? This is back like in the...
Right.
Because it would have been, what, the 1920s, 1930s? Mm-hmm. You don't have... There were so many kids, and she was, what, going into high school at the time? So she's, like, 14,
right,
15. And at that point, the grandpa's like, you need to go get married. Like, you need to go and start a life, right? So she does. At 19, she ends up getting married, and then that doesn't work out. And then the other one is the one she had, she was in a relationship with them and never married, but that's when she had the affair with what is believed to be John Rockefeller's son.
Yes.
And so you have this woman, I don't know, like I kind of agree, maybe prestige, but to me, if she was responsible for this,
it's quite interesting.
The nerve, right? Yeah. The nerve to put yourself there knowing you murdered this man. There's some distorted
unless
thinking
she
there.
Was, unless she also probably did it just so that she can keep her, I guess, status. Like people to keep talking about, like, oh my gosh, did you know she's buried there too? Like, so people can still keep talking about her.
Well, aren't we talking about her today? Like, that's why I find these kind of cases so fascinating when we go back so many years. It's like, would these people know, like, we're talking about them today, right? Or an article was just written about them 2 years ago, right? In the Texas Monthly.
Like, they're probably looking down on
you
us.
Know?
Like, she's probably like, okay, so they're talking about us. They're talking about us. Let's keep it going.
Let's hopefully only see certain things, because Chris and I were recording one day and the lights flickered.
Oh,
and
dear.
We were like, I know. And we just both look up and then look at each other like, I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't be talking
just
about
our
this.
House sucks. That's
Yeah, that's true. We did have the electrical system changed. That things don't flicker anymore.
Well,
we
have some interesting electrical issues. Periodically have to jiggle a breaker. We need a new panel. That's what I'm chalking that up to.
Well, this was the case of Candace Mosler. I like going back in some Texas history with this true crime stuff. And, you know, the justice system is a fascinating thing, right? And
it's quite interesting.
You would think with the circumstantial evidence, even though they didn't have a lot of physical evidence tying both of them, you know, you have the flight records of Mel coming in from Houston on a one-way. And Chris asked at the live show, why only a one-way ticket? And I think it's because they didn't know when it was going to happen. She had to make sure she had the kids out of the house.
Right.
Right. What if it wasn't a good time? She would have either had to let him in or give him a key. Like, I think there was some planning to it. And I think those four days in a row that she went to the hospital to have some injection, there was some sort of communication. There had to have been something going on in the planning process. I'm not convinced that she went to the hospital all four of those days with a migraine. I think there was probably she was leaving the home to plan. So Candace Mosler. So Texas history, true crime is interesting. Thank you for having us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on a case. I want to start doing, I hope other winemakers are listening and want us to come and visit and do cases with them. Yeah, because, you know, we like mentioning y'all, but when we can be with you in front and talk about your wine and sip it with you and just see so much passion and love in what you guys do, it really does mean a lot
to
us.
Well, and we do spend a lot of time plugging y'all and all the various winemakers, so we like an opportunity for you to get some plugs as well, too.
Yeah, we like to come visit, you know, and come see all these places that we only can see on the internet, and they send us wine, so we want to, thank you.
So how we heard about y'all was through OG Cellars.
Oh, okay.
Because I saw a post on it and I asked James, I said, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's Texas Wine and True Crime. And I was like, how do you get your wines there? And he's like, well, just contact them. I was like, yes. Alrighty.
Oh,
so, yeah. Cool. Very cool.
And you did. I did. Yes. And then I contacted you and said, let's go do this together live. So
I love talking about these type of things because everything, it's always different scenarios on how it ends up. And it's always pretty cool to see how these cases went down.
Yes. Yeah. So. Well, because I think just the, it is because, you know, you have juries in most of these, right? Where we see mm-hmm. these like really bizarre outcomes in these cases, and you have to think, what were they thinking? Right. From an outsider, and we're reading about these cases and learning about them. And then when you go and read, like, by the way, I love newspapers.com. You can go find anything that's archived,
yes.
right?
Oh, yes.
And so when you see what was actually happening at that time and how people were thinking is very fascinating to me. So it is. It's interesting to see how, you know, would she have been found not guilty nowadays? Probably not. No, like, you know, we don't have the, I don't think the sympathetic, but then we have
not the technologies we have nowadays.
That's right.
I mean, it's
harder to get away with
our
things.
Forensics technologies have definitely gone a lot better over the years. I mean, because now I'm hearing they're starting to look at older cases and redoing all the evidence.
And solving them.
And solving
40, 50 years.
I mean, they've just solved a few recently, and it's pretty interesting to see that our technology nowadays are helping solve crime back in the day.
And thankfully, because there's a lot of families that still have missing loved ones.
Yes.
Or just unsolved murders. That
and
there's
not
no one accountability.
Closure.
Yeah. And they don't have the closure. So, all right. Well, thank you again for joining us, Chris. Thank you as always. Until next time, friends.
Absolutely.
Stay safe, have fun, and cheers to next time.
Cheers.